So the topic of my presentation today is to introduce how the brain develops and to talk a little bit about how experience influences the developing brain. And what I want to start with is a little overview of what we're going to talk about in terms of the adult brain. And so in a second, when this movie starts, you'll see what is the adult brain. Of course, the adult brain is not colored like this, but what I'm trying to demonstrate here, as soon as I can pause this, is the various structures that you can see in the adult configuration. And what I want you to pay particular attention to is this gyral and sulcal pattern, that is the infoldings in the brain, because that's something you will not see in an early developing brain. So with that in mind, let me now talk about what develops. So this is an overview of human brain development, and one point I'm trying to make here is that brain development does not end at birth or at the age of 3. What we're going to be describing in some detail are the events that begin shortly after birth, right through here, and that continue throughout the lifespan. And these patterns of development, which as you see continue way out into the adolescent years, represent the fact that brain development is in some respects a very protracted phase of development and does not end again at the age of 3, contrary to what one sometimes reads in the newspapers. So, let me begin with some basic embryology. Following conception, the formation of egg and sperm lead to the creation of what we refer to as a zygote. So the zygote is at first a two-celled organism, egg and sperm, and then it rapidly divides and it forms a ball of cells called the blastocyst. And this happens about a week after conception. The blastocyst then divides into an inner layer and an outer layer. The outer layer will become the support structures for the baby, the placenta, umbilical cord, amniotic sac. The inner layer of the embryo will become the inner layer of the blastocyst will become the embryo. So this is an illustration of these various components. So again, here's the embryo, and this comes from the inner layer of the blastocyst, and the placenta and the umbilical cord here and the amniotic sac are all the structures that derive from the external layer of the blastocyst. Now, between the first and the second week after conception, the inner layer itself begins to subdivide and eventually divides into 3 layers. So, just to recap, zygote, blastocyst, inner layer, outer layer support, inner layer embryo. Now, the inner layer between the first and the second week subdivides yet again into inner, middle, and outer layers. The inner layer of the embryo will become our organs, liver, spleen, heart, things like that. The middle layer of this embryo now will become the muscle and skeletal system. And then the outer layer of the ectoderm will go on to become the coverings of the body, the skin, for example, and the nervous system. And so we're going to focus almost all of our attention then on the outer layer of the embryo, embryonic development, referred to as the ectoderm. So, if the blastocyst forms in the first week and then the embryo divides out into inner layer, middle layer, and outer layer in the first and second week, sometime as we approach the third week, by around the 18th day, the first phase of brain development begins, and it's ushered in by a process we refer to as neurulation, or the construction of the neural tube. So, again, and I'll show pictures of all this in just a moment, the dorsal or the rear side of the ectodermal layer will begin to thicken and form a pear-shaped neural plate. The plate will then form a groove, and the groove will become a tube. The tube will close, and cells trapped inside the tube become the central nervous system, and cells trapped outside the neural tube will become the autonomic nervous system. So let me now show all of these events to you. So now around the 18th day, the dorsal or rear side of the ectoderm, so imagine that that's my hand, begins to thicken through this process of cell multiplication, mitosis. So the cells are increasing in number, and as they increase in number, this becomes thicker and thicker and forms a neural plate. Gradually, a groove begins to form. This is an electron micrograph on this side here where my mouse cursor is. Begins to form a groove, which you can see again here. And as we're approaching now the 20th or so day, the groove folds over onto itself. And so, again, imagine now my hand is getting thicker. It forms a groove. That's the groove here. And then it folds over onto itself, forming a tube. And by around the 24th day, the tube will close at the top end and the bottom end. And that completes the cycle of the construction of the neural tube. Cells that are trapped inside, here's another, let me give you yet another example. I have several illustrations of this. So again, you can see here, maybe I'll do it this way, in this electron micrograph, there's the groove, here it is again, and now it got deeper, and then it folds over onto itself to form a tube. And this is the axis we're talking about, right here. And so you can see this again here. The top of the tube will go on to give rise to what we refer to as the telencephalon or the prosencephalon. Think of that as your cortex for the most part. And then we'll have midbrain and hindbrain structures. And then the rest of this all become the spinal cord. And so this neural tube, which extends this whole longitudinal dimension, is critical to brain development. And problems in neural tube formation can lead to catastrophic consequences that are incompatible with life. I'll give you an example in a moment. Or somewhat benign consequences, such as spina bifida. And what I'm saying here, then, is that if during this process of neural tube closure there has been an error someplace, then you will see a defect in neural tube formation. Two examples of this would include spina bifida or open spine, and a second would be anencephaly. And so I want you to be aware that the next two slides are rather graphic. This is spina bifida. This is actually complicated spina bifida, many other problems with this child. But what I'm trying to illustrate is in this region of the spine, the neural tube failed to close. And then the coverings, which is also, of course, part of the ectodermal layer, also failed to close. An analogy here, perhaps, are spinal cord injuries in the adult. So depending on the height of the injury would determine the degree to which there'd be motor problems. A child like this would probably be paralyzed through most of the body, have no bowel and bladder control and the like. But a lesion way down in the lumbar region might just lead to lower extremity difficulties. And such children are usually perfectly fine cognitively, but impaired motorically. Now, in anencephaly, which is a much more catastrophic thing and is, in fact, incompatible with life, the top of the neural tube fails to close. And so, again, this is complicated, but in this particular case, because I've seen several children like this who look perfectly normal at birth, who have, in fact, anencephaly. And the way you know that is if you hold a light to their head and you, what's referred to as transilluminate them, their head will glow like a light bulb because all that's in there is spinal fluid. So the brain stem and the hindbrain might be intact, but the whole cortex is completely missing. And so many such infants are stillborn or die, of course, so the mom might spontaneously abort the fetus. Such infants will live for sometimes a few weeks after birth, but that's it. Let's not belabor that slide. But assuming that doesn't happen and neural tube formation occurs, goes off without a hitch, then the next stage of brain development, once the neural tube has closed, is this process of neurogenesis, which is the genesis, of course, being origin, so the creation of brain cells. So what begins to happen then is that the primitive cells that have now lined the neural tube, outside of the neural tube, again, are neural crest cells that give rise to the autonomic nervous system. But inside the tube, which is what we'll focus on, are a set of cells that begin to, in a sense, mature and become a formal neuron. And so you know there are different classes of brain cells. The two major classes are neurons and glia. Neurons are the cells that really communicate with one another. Glia provide a form of support for those neurons. The neurons basically start to be made shortly after the neural tube closes, roughly the sixth or so prenatal week. It had, until fairly recently, been assumed that neurogenesis was something that completed its course by birth. And as a result, the newborn had all the neurons it would ever have, with one exception I'll tell you about in a moment, and that you would not make new neurons any time after birth. And as a result, the consequences of that, of course, is that the brain cannot repair itself the way, say, the skin can. So if you have a catastrophic brain injury that damages neurons, you can't make new neurons in response to that. That is still true, but what we now know not to be true is that, in fact, there is such a thing as postnatal neurogenesis. Now, we've known for many years that the exception to this rule was the the olfactory system, where in fact on almost a weekly basis the cells in the olfactory bulb are in fact made anew. But over the last 5 to 10 years there have been some very dramatic discoveries made by a number of individuals that indicate that in other regions of the brain we continue to make new neurons well into postnatal life. The area that everyone agrees where this occurs is the dentate gyrus, a region of the hippocampus. But Elizabeth Gould at Princeton has also argued that some regions of the parietal cortex and the frontal cortex, particularly the cingulate, may in fact make new neurons as well. We know in the dentate gyrus of the hippocampus, and again, the hippocampus is a structure very involved in the formation of memory, that postnatal neurogenesis is profoundly influenced by experience. So rats, for example, reared in complex environments that, where they're being challenged and learning and memory is being challenged, show an increase in neurogenesis, whereas rats being reared in stressful environments show a downregulation of neurogenesis. So then, therefore, we know that postnatal neurogenesis, at least in the dentate, is influenced by some postnatal experiences as well. Dr. Gould has reported recently that these cells paradoxically are short-lived. That is, they are born, but they seem to pass away generally in just a few weeks, which raises the challenge of, so why are we making new cells if they don't last that long? And how do these cells get into existing circuits? And we don't really know the answers to those questions right now, although Gould and others do in fact believe that these cells do play an important role in learning and memory. We know the cells mature to adult-like status. They go on to develop express neurotransmitters and the like. So it's not like these are an immature cell that gets then retracted. They are in fact mature cells that have mature function, but nevertheless they don't seem to live all that long. It appears that this postnatal neurogenesis varies in terms of how long it will go on. It appears that in the human, it may be until the 40s that we're continuing to produce new cells in the dentate gyrus. This has been made possible by new staining techniques, and for all we know, with advances in ways of looking at the brain, we might uncover yet other mysteries about postnatal neurogenesis in the years to come. Now, keep in mind now that unlike neurulation, which sort of ends, we do continue to make new cells, but we then usher in yet another stage of brain development, superimposed on top of the fact that we are continuing to make neurons. And this is this process of cell migration. So now imagine a scenario in which we're making neurons, and once a neuron has been made, then it enters into this next cycle of brain development that we refer to as cell migration. So what begins to happen here, and I'm going to focus specifically just on neurons now, not glia, is that these now developed neurons need to find their place in the brain to create a cortex. And they do that by migrating to a specific part of the brain. And any common pattern of migration is radial migration. That is, prior to the formation of the neuron is the formation of a glial element, or a type of glial cell called a radial glial fiber, onto which the neuron attaches itself. And then the neuron, getting signals, usually hormonal and local signals, knows where to go in this path of the radial glial fiber, and knows basically its subway stop. So we use that as an analogy. Imagine getting on the subway at one stop, and you know what your stop is. How do you know? Well, because someone gave you directions, or you've just done it enough times. Here, it's not, someone doesn't tell the neuron where to go. It just knows it from various genetic codings and signals it gets from its local environment. What happens in this process then is, imagine this neuron has attached itself to this radial glial fiber, and it migrates out and it gets to this stop and it says, this is where this is my stop, I'm getting off, and it hops off. Another neuron has another stop and it hops off. This occurs in wave after wave. So again, using this as my diagram here, here's the radial glial process, here's the migrating neuron. Eventually, the neurons migrate out to form 6 layers of the cortex. And this is actual cell migration in the ferret brain. Susan McConnell, a professor of neurobiology at Stanford, has made these films. And I want you to keep your eye on some of these white dots here, which you'll see are moving. There are others, other places in this film as well. What you're looking at then is not in real time. This is a movie, of course. I don't have a ferret in my computer. But what you're looking at is a neuron that has attached itself to a radioglial fiber and has been migrating along its trajectory for some number of hours until it realizes this is where I belong. And at that point, it gets off and sets up shop. Now, cell migration begins around the sixth prenatal week and is complete by around the fifth to sixth prenatal month in most regions of the cortex. In all, six layers of the cortex get formed, but as well, we have columns of related cells. So imagine six different neurons all migrate to six different layers, but they do so in a way so that they are actually vertically aligned through the cortex, leading to a column of cells. And we think these columns have functional properties. An example would be ocular dominance columns in the visual cortex. So cell migration, then, in summary, is a process whereby the cortex is actually formed. It forms by these neurons moving through the brain and forming six layers and then columns of related cells. And in most cases, cell migration is complete, again, by the fifth to the sixth prenatal month. What are errors of cell migration? Well, right now, an area of encyclopathology that's received a lot of attention is schizophrenia. Daniel Weinberger at the NIMH, among others, has argued that schizophrenia may in fact be a neurodevelopmental disorder due to errors in cell migration. Another common disorder would be agenesis of the corpus callosum. The corpus callosum, of course, is the big bundle of fibers that connects the two hemispheres and allows interhemispheric communication. Agenesis simply refers to the lack of. So there are children who are born without a corpus callosum. And unlike adults who have their corpus callosum split for epilepsy surgery, children who are born without a corpus callosum can be remarkably asymptomatic and normal. And then there are many, many cases of such children, no one knowing they don't have a corpus callosum until one day they fall off their bike and they hit their head and they go to the emergency room and they decide to do a CT scan, and the radiologist comes out and says, your child has no corpus callosum. And usually the mom or the dad says, and what's a corpus callosum? But the point is that this illustrates the dramatic difference between a child born without a structure and damaging a structure in the mature brain. Finally, prematurity is maybe an example of incomplete cell migration. There are now many, many infants born in this country who are born at 24 to 25 weeks gestation, sometimes in some places 23 and a half weeks gestation. And this is what the brain looks like in a baby born at 25 weeks. What you should notice, in contrast to the very first slide I showed, is there is no gyral pattern here. There's a major sulcus that separates the two hemispheres. So just to orient you, the temporal lobe is over by the ear, frontal lobe, occipital lobe back here, parietal lobe in here. But there's really very little gyral pattern. And this is what the brain looks like if you're born at 25 weeks. What's even more amazing is that many such infants will, in fact, if they can be spared the various medical complications that are common at this age, will in fact go on to look quite normal. And that is truly amazing given the status of their brain at birth. So once cell migration has completed itself, we get into the next stage of brain development, and that's differentiation and synaptogenesis. So the neuron has been formed. It's migrated, but it's not quite yet. Think of migration as the teenager leaving the house to go to college, but they're not still a fully formed adult, at least according to the parents. Now the teenager has gotten to where they're going to go. They're in their dorm room, and now they differentiate, which means in this case, they've matured. Now, leaving that analogy aside, because you'll see in a moment it really is not a very good analogy for a very good reason, a number of events can occur. The cell can fully form and form a cell body and then form processes, axons and dendrites, or the cell can die. That's why I didn't want to push this analogy, and I probably now regret having used that analogy. So 40 to 60% of all neurons initially born go on to die. It's referred to as apoptosis. It's a perfectly normative process. We know that in some cases it's highly regulated by a certain set of genes. But of the cells that don't die, then a number of things can happen. As I said, the cell body, the soma can form, and if that forms, sometimes axons and dendrites, which is referred to as processes, they can also form. And if they form, then another scenario can occur in which they make connections with one another, and this is referred to as the formation of a synapse or synaptogenesis. So let me give you an example of the complexity of this. You've all heard figures about the number of neurons we have and figures about the number of synapses we have. We should take most of these things with a grain of salt because, in fact, it's very difficult to count to 10 to the 6th or 10 to the 7th. This is an example of a simple dendritic field, and I'll explain that in just a minute. I need to get this moving. So what you're looking at is a single neuron here with any number of dendrites. So any a common scenario is a single cell body with a single axon and many dendrites. And that means all of those dendrites are capable of forming a connection with other axons in neighboring regions, and that axon can form connections with dendrites from other neurons. So this is a dendritic field, that is multiple dendrites. And if I let this complete itself, and I'll go to the next one, and now you'll see this is now a whole cluster of neurons and dendrites together. So this is just a small number of neurons. You can imagine the complexity then that if we have, let's say, 10 to the 6th neurons, each of those neurons can form thousands of connections. You can only imagine the number of possible synapses we have in the nervous system. And when I talk more in a moment about synaptogenesis, you'll realize the challenge of sitting there and counting how many synapses exist in the human nervous system. So here's an example of how this might actually occur. There's a sound that goes with this, but it's not critical that we hear this. In fact, maybe I'll turn the sound off. What we're looking at here, this is an excitatory neuron, and in a second you'll see information is being transmitted along the excitatory neuron to the target neuron, which then excites this neuron. So this would be propagation. So this is the point of contact, the synapse itself. Neurotransmitter might be released in here that aids the connection between the two cells. We have different types of neurons. An excitatory neuron is designed to excite a neighboring neuron. An inhibitory neuron is designed to inhibit a neighboring neuron. And so what we're trying to argue here is that the synapse then is, in fact, the point of connection, and it represents how neurons communicate with one another. The process of synaptogenesis is very fascinating for a number of reasons. It turns out that like neurons, as I said before, we make a lot of neurons, and then 40 to 60% of them will actually die. We also massively overproduce synapses. So the newborn brain has many more synapses than the adult brain does. This overproduction is then followed by a period of retraction where the number of synapses gradually declines to adult levels. And this declining, or this retraction of synapses, actually varies from area to area. So let's first talk about the overproduction of synapses. In the visual cortex, the peak of overproduction seems to occur around the fourth postnatal month. In the primary and auditory cortex, a similar timetable is followed. So what we're saying then is, in the sensory cortices for vision and hearing, the peak of overproduction occurs at around 4 postnatal months. In areas involved in receptive language or language production, in either the temporal or the frontal cortex, the peak occurs a little bit after 4 months, so it lags slightly behind the simple auditory cortex. So if you think of this functionally, the ability to hear, the auditory cortex, has a peak of synaptogenesis slightly before our ability to use hearing in the service of language. And finally, in the frontal cortex, at least the one area that's received the most attention, the middle frontal gyrus, the peak of synaptogenesis does not occur until about a year. So in summary then, the peak is about 4 months in the visual cortex and 12 months in the frontal cortex. But this changes entirely when it comes to the retraction of synapses. So in the visual and auditory cortex, adult levels of synapses tend to be reached between 2 and 6 years of age, sometime during preschool for the most part, whereas in the middle frontal gyrus and the frontal cortex, adult levels are not reached until mid to late adolescence. And so this is an example of that. The solid line here represents the visual cortex. And so the peak of overproduction occurs around 4 months, and then there's a retraction. And by around, you know, the preschool years, the number of synapses stabilizes to adult levels. In contrast, in the frontal cortex, the peak is at about a year, and adult levels of synapses are not reached until mid to late adolescence. So to summarize, synapse overproduction occurs early in life, whereas synapse elimination occurs much later and varies greatly area by area. So, for example, 4 to 6 years for the visual cortex, 15 plus years for the prefrontal cortex. This leads us to ask, why do we overproduce synapses? Why not just create the right number and leave it at that? Now, I don't personally know the answer to that. No one really knows the answer to that because no one's confided in us who creates the nervous system. But the speculation is that we overproduce synapses in order to capture experience and thereby prune and cultivate a synaptic field. This means the overproduction of synapses can be adaptive for the organism, a period of opportunity, but alas, it can also be maladaptive, a period of vulnerability, depending on the nature of experience. So if the experiences are bad, then it's probably to the detriment of the organism to have overproduced synapses because you're then confirming and stabilizing synapses in a maladaptive configuration. This led J. McVicker Hunt to coin the term plasticity cuts both ways, meaning that plasticity reflects the phenomenon whereby we are taking advantage of the overproduction of synapses by experience, but depending on the nature of the experience can determine whether the brain will proceed on a good direction or a bad direction. I'm going to spend much more time shortly discussing this process of how experience influences synaptogenesis, but before I do that, let me first introduce the last stage of brain development, or the last phase of brain development, which is myelination. Myelin is a lipid protein substance. In the central nervous system, it is produced by a specific type of glial cell called an oligodendroglia. And what it does is it coats an axon with this protein lipid substance that improves the ability of that axon to transmit electrical impulses. So it increases conduction velocity. And in so doing, it improves the efficiency with which the brain works. So myelination has implications for both serial and parallel processing, in other words, multitasking. And myelination begins in waves, beginning around the last third of gestation in prenatal development and ending in young adulthood, although there are some data to suggest that there are elements of brain that continue to myelinate into middle age. So Francine Bennis at Harvard, for example, has demonstrated that the hippocampus may still be laying down myelin in middle age. Historically, the way one looked for myelin in the brain was disdain for it in postmortem tissue. But now you can use magnetic resonance imaging and a correlate of that diffusion tensor imaging to look at myelin. The virtue of this is that we now have a completely non-invasive way of looking at large numbers of subjects at how myelin is formed in the brain and how myelin might be broken down in the brain in diseases like MS, where there's a degradation of myelin. So let's talk a little bit in more detail. Beginning in prenatal, the last trimester, and then early in postnatal life, some of the systems that are myelinating include the sensory roots and the motor roots, sense of touch, primary visual systems, things like that. So think of the parts of the nervous system that myelinate first are those involved in our sensory and motor functionings. In the first postnatal year, regions of the brainstem and the cerebellum start to myelinate, and portions of the corpus callosum have also begun to myelinate. And by about a year of age, all regions of the corpus callosum are beginning to myelinate, although there is much debate about by what point in development that occurs. Some estimates are not until the age of 10. Others argue that closer to 5 or 6 years. But be that as it may, the corpus callosum begins myelinating in that first postnatal year, but doesn't complete myelinating till later on. Now, through the pre-adolescent period, I really probably should have said the prepubescent period because puberty is a critical issue here, we observe an increase in gray matter. So I should add now that gray matter are basically areas of the brain that have no myelin in them. Cell bodies would be an example. And white matter is the areas of the brain that have myelin in them, axons, for example. So through the prepubescent period, we observe an increase in gray matter, which some have speculated might reflect more dendritic spines. So before I argued that we have a cell body and dendrites and axons, spines are these little elements that sit on dendrites, and it's actually the spine that forms the contact with an adjacent, say, axon for the synapse. So we think that there might be an increase in gray matter, maybe more spine development, pre-puberty, and a decrease in white, and then this will reverse in adolescence. That is, there's a decrease in gray and an increase in white. Now, regarding the first one, it's not clear to me that there's actually a decrease in white, rather than because of the increase in gray, there's less white apparent. But clearly in adolescence, what starts to happen is an increase in white, and that's probably an increase in connectivity in the brain, and that's what we're observing. The changes of note that occur during adolescence tend to be primarily in the frontal lobes and some regions of the temporal lobe. And in a moment, I'll come back to the significance of that. So piecing two critical bits of information again together, the last area of the brain to become adult-like in synapses is the frontal cortex. The last area of the brain to myelinate is the frontal cortex. So those data look good together. And if we had time and we talked about neuropsychological development, I would argue that the last functions to emerge in child development are those subserved by the prefrontal cortex, such as executive functions, which don't reach adult levels until mid to late adolescence. So in summary, this goes through the various stages of brain development, beginning with neurulation, or the construction of the neural tube, then migration and synaptogenesis. Synaptogenesis, postnatal neurogenesis. We, of course, have through here prenatal neurogenesis. Myelination, gyrification simply refers to the development of that gyral pattern. And then neurochemical development, which starts in intrauterine life and proceeds through adolescence. I don't want to go through this in great detail. This is a little bit more detail than I provided in my talk, but since this, you will have access to this table, you can look at this at your own leisure. What I now want to talk about, if I can just pause for just a moment, is the process whereby experience affects brain development. Because everything I've said so far implies that brains develop on their own accord. There's some genetic program that just regulates brain development. And although that is true to some degree, particularly prenatally, what all neuroscientists now agree is that experience, particularly postnatal experience, provides a major avenue by which brains develop. So what I now want to talk about are the processes whereby experience gets into the brain. And one way Bill Greeno and others have referred to this is, how does the structure of experience get into the structure of the brain? And this is actually critical to understanding not just human brain development, but functional brain development. So again, we know there are genes that regulate many aspects of brain development, particularly prenatally, and to some degree postnatally, of course, as well. But what I want to talk about now are the remarkable ways that experience influences brain development. And you'll see shortly that it isn't restricted to just postnatal. I'll give examples of how experience influences prenatal brain development as well. This general concept of how experience influences brain is sometimes referred to as plasticity. And so what I want to do to begin with is talk a little bit about some of the general principles of plasticity. So some of the terms that may sound familiar to you are things like recovery of function. So this refers to the way cortical function or function in general would return following some injury. A good example would be the work on hemispherectomy, that is, when a hemisphere has been removed, and kids go on to develop language and to walk and do all those normal things. Sparing refers to the lack of loss in performance following brain damage when you expected it to occur. So a good example is when I was an undergraduate at McGill University, Donald Head would talk about studies that Penfield and Milner and others had done on frontal cortex. So you'd have an individual with epilepsy where they would have to remove a big chunk of the frontal cortex to remove the seizure focus, and their IQ would go up several, 5 or 10 points. Now, this was not an endorsement of having brain surgery to increase your IQ. It was arguing that, in some respects, you can spare function in spite of frank brain injury. So these are sort of companion principles. Recovery of function is when recovery comes back after an initial deficit. Sparing, you never lost the function despite the fact that you had some injury to your brain. And neuroplasticity is basically hypothesized to underlie both of these principles. How does the brain, in a sense, reorganize, or in the case of development, organize to lead to either new behaviors or changes in behavior? And that's what we want to talk about. Greeno has proposed two major types of plasticity, that is, synapse-dependent, experience-expectant, and experience-dependent. Experience-expectant development usually refers to the following scenario, that as a species, we are born expecting certain experiences to occur to all members of the species. So therefore, you only have to code into the nervous system the expectation that these experiences will occur. And as a result, when those experiences occur, development will proceed normally. And I'll give examples in a moment, but the way many aspects of our visual system works would be an example of experience expectant development. Thus, all babies should be born expecting access to a normal visual world of patterned light information. Experience-dependent plasticity, however, is unique to the individual. It most likely involves the active formation of new synapses, and the classic example of experience-dependent development would be learning and memory. And now I'm going to go through both of these in some detail. Let me begin with what I'm going to refer to as developmental plasticity. By this, I simply mean examples of malleability in the brain, in the developing brain, and by developing brain, I'm meaning the child's brain. Versus the adult brain, and I'm hard-pressed to argue when the child becomes the adult, but for the sake of convention, let's just say after the teenage years we're an adult and before that we're a child. Classic examples of developmental plasticity. Prenatal exposure to teratogens, we know, alters brain development. That's an example of maladaptive plasticity. So a fetus exposed to cocaine, to alcohol, to cigarettes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all act as teratogens which can alter brain development. So that's one example of prenatal plasticity. And of course, prenatal exposure to stress would be another. We know from work with rodents, with monkeys, and a little bit from humans, that prenatal exposure to stress can lead to long-term deficits. So Mary Schneider at the University of Wisconsin, for example, has shown that pregnant monkeys exposed to unpredictable loud sounds, akin perhaps to a fire alarm going off in the classroom, but on an unpredictable nature, give birth to fetuses, to baby monkeys, rather, that show all sorts of neurobehavioral problems that appear to persist well into life. It's much more complicated, of course, to study this phenomenon in the human because it's harder to define what we mean by stress and to correlate it and to time lock it with particular stages of brain development, but it is pause for concern. And so the point of these two examples is that stress and teratogens can deleteriously affect brain development. Now, one might ask, are there beneficial experiences prenatally? And perhaps there are. An example might be nutritional supplements that we have yet to uncover that might, in fact, be beneficial to the developing brain, that we might supplement the mother's diet. Or, in an analogous fashion, we know now that supplementing a pregnant woman's diet with folic acid has greatly reduced the likelihood of neural tube defects occurring. This is not to say that neural tube defects are due to or caused by a lack of folic acid, but epidemiologically it does show that sufficient supplies of folic acid reduce the likelihood of having a child with a neural tube defect. So that is an example, again, of plasticity. How about after the baby is born? So, I mentioned a moment ago that the normal development of vision depends on access to a normal visual world during a sensitive period of development. And here's what I mean by that. If we, given that we may only have 30,000 genes, it's probably not a good use of genes to have hundreds of them dedicated to developing just our ability to see. Instead, we might have a smaller number that says these aspects of the visual system will develop, and experience will then drive the rest of that development. What are those experiences? Pattern light information would be an example. So there are two ways to undermine this. Well, two broad class of ways to undermine this. One would be if there's a problem in the visual system itself. So a baby is born with strabismus. Their eyes cannot converge on an object, or their eyes wander. And everyone has seen this in babies, and we all know people who have still have strabismus. So what happens is that the eyes are expecting input our brain is expecting input from both eyes to converge in a particular way in the visual system. If the eyes can't make a vergence movement like this, or it's wandering around like that, what will happen is that one eye will become very dominant, will lose the ability to see depth in three dimensions using the two eyes, which is a major class of depth cues. And it may over time lead to one eye being very underpowered. So we have not just a dominant eye, but we may have an eye that doesn't work very well. And again, we probably all either know people like this, or maybe you are one of those people where you're looking at someone and one eye is looking at you and the other eye, you're not quite sure where it's looking, and that's because that eye does not see very well because of strabismus. We know that strabismus needs to be corrected during the critical period of synaptogenesis in the visual cortex. So I said earlier in my talk that The peak of overproduction in the visual cortex of synapses is around 4 months, but the retraction is complete sometime during the preschool years. So now we know all pediatric ophthalmologists are aware that they need to correct this visual problem before that retraction has occurred, because after that, there's no more plasticity in the system, and you cannot correct strabismus after that. Of course, another way to undermine this as an expectable environment would be child neglect. So the visual system may be perfectly intact, but if a child is being brought up in a closet, there's a case of a child being reared in a coffin in Chicago a number of years, the child has no visual information. Or in some work I do in an orphanage in Romania, the base rate of strabismus is very high because these infants lie on their backs staring at a white ceiling for the first year of life, and there's no pattern information to drive their visual system. The development of speech perception may be another example of plasticity. Patricia Kuhl and Janet Worker and others have demonstrated that infants in the first half of life are capable of discriminating the speech sounds from almost any language in the world. But as they approach about a year or so, this window narrows and they become less able to discriminate foreign speech sounds and better able to discriminate the sounds that they're exposed to on a daily basis. And perhaps another example, our group has shown that face perception may work the same way, that the system is broadly tuned at first to discriminate all kinds of faces, but with experience you become more specialized. So for example, we've demonstrated that a 6-month-old can discriminate monkey faces as well as human faces, but by 9 months they have now started to lose the ability to discriminate monkey faces and look like human adults who have a very hard time with monkey faces. So this narrowing of the perceptual window in speech and maybe in faces represents a sensitive period of development during which you need to be exposed to particular things. So in speech, for example, one might hypothesize that if an infant was being brought up in Cambridge with English-speaking parents, but was exposed for the first several years to Thai, Czech, and Japanese, they would maintain the ability to discriminate those speech contrasts. And of course, anyone who was brought up with multiple languages is well aware of this. And in the case of faces, one might argue that if you brought up babies seeing monkey faces for a long time as well as human faces, they would retain the ability to discriminate monkey faces. No one, however, has volunteered for that particular manipulation. What are some other examples of developmental plasticity? We've known for many, many years that damage to the hippocampus, bilateral damage, that is in both hemispheres in the adult brain, leads to an impairment called anterograde amnesia, the inability to form new memories. But there's a group of children being studied in London who suffered bilateral damage to the hippocampus as infants. And as they get older, they do in fact show deficits in memory, but they show remarkable sparing of a particular type of memory referred to as semantic memory, or knowledge and facts and the like. That does not happen in the adult brain. And so there seems to be either sparing or recovery of function in the case of children who've incurred damage to the hippocampus in contrast to the adults. Similarly, Elizabeth Bates has demonstrated that children born with large focal lesions in their brain, perhaps the whole left frontal cortex has been damaged due to a stroke, after an initial shaky start will go on to develop pretty normal language. Again, if we had comparable damage, we would have dense aphasia of one sort or another, and this has not happened with the developing child. Paula Talal and Mike Mersnich have demonstrated that some language disorders can be improved by stretching out the timing between consonants. So the argument that they've made is that some kids have a language problem, they can't hear the difference between certain sounds because the sounds come too quickly for them. And if you can't hear the difference, you can't make those sounds correctly. And of course, the classic example in foreign language is the RL distinction in Japanese. So an individual who did not, a native Japanese speaker who did not learn English early in life, has a very hard time pronouncing R and L because they can't hear the difference between R and L. And now Jim McClelland and others have demonstrated intense training programs that in the adult can in fact allow you to hear that distinction and then produce the R and L correctly. So those are some examples of developmental plasticity. I could give others, but let me just summarize by saying that in most cases, or at least in sensory and perceptual development, and maybe in some aspects of cognitive and linguistic development, these things will proceed normally if such systems are set correctly during a sensitive period of development. And by sensitive, I mean a period of time during which the brain is expecting certain experiences to occur. And it's a rather narrow period of time. It could be months or it could be a few years. However, the quality of the environmental input following this the sensitive period may also influence the quality and the trajectory of subsequent development. So an example, the ability of the baby to form an attachment with his or her primary caregiver probably is an experience expectant phenomenon. As a species, we're so immature at birth that we just expect that we need caregiving, someone to take care of us. And that generally does occur throughout almost all members of our species. But the quality of the caregiving will influence the quality of the attachment. So we might think of the formation of an attachment as an experience expectant process, but the quality of the attachment is an experience dependent process. Again, there's no data to support this definitively, but it's the use of this model extending it to the domain of social emotional development. So let's now turn to some examples of adult plasticity. There's a long history of housing rats, usually adult rats, in complex environments. As an undergraduate, I remember hearing Hebb talk about getting permission from his wife to bring his rats home, thinking that if they had the run of the house, they would be smarter rats. And in fact, that's exactly what he showed. This work was then taken up by Diamond and Rosenzweig and others, and demonstrating that rats reared in complex environments, by which I mean non-laboratory sterile environments, just a little cage with a rat living all alone, and I'll show you an example in just a minute, tend to do better on various cognitive measures, and they show dramatic differences in their brain. Thicker cortical expanse, more neural connections, greater metabolism, blood flow to the brain, and the like. This is an example of a complex environment. It is not an enriched environment, contrary to what many of us sometimes associate this with. It's not enriched because this is probably impoverished relative to the environment the rat lives in the streets of Cambridge or Boston, but rather is complex compared to the rat lab that one sees in, say, a psych or a neuroscience department. So what you see here is, think of this as a sophisticated daycare center for rats. You have the toys, lots of good toys, and the toys are changed daily, and there's the right number of rats, not too many, not too few. In fact, you don't get the effects I mentioned for rats being raised alone in these environments. They need the social contact. And you don't get these effects if there are too many rats, if there's crowding going on. So they have a good diet and they have this complex environment, and they show all these wonderful effects. Of course, many people have tried to extend this to the human, and that is a point of discussion for another lecture about the extent to which how easily one can extend this to the human, although it is tempting. What are some other examples? Well, let's talk about the motor and somatosensory systems. A number of years ago, there was a controversial case at the National Institutes of Health led by Edward Taub, then at NIH, that has become known as the Silver Spring Monkeys. Taub had been doing studies deafferenting monkeys in which he cut the fibers, the outgoing fibers, so that the monkey could move the arm, but it had no sensation at all. So it could reach this laser pointer, but it wouldn't know it had the laser pointer in its hand. And that usually leads to this disuse of the arm. Not that because of paralysis, but just because there's no sense in doing something if you don't have any sense of feel. Well, what happened is that Taub's lab was closed down, a lawsuit ensued, the monkeys were sequestered in Florida for a long number of years, during the time this lawsuit was moving through the courts. One side wanted to euthanize the animals, arguing that that's the most humane thing to do to them. Another side said, no, they should live free in the wild. Well, eventually, it was resolved that the animals should, in fact, be sacrificed. But by now, it's many years later. Taub and Tim Pons and Mort Mishkin and several others looked at the somatosensory cortex of these monkeys and discovered huge reorganization. The area of the brain that was adjacent to the part that represented the deafferented limb had increased in expanse, suggesting that over time the brain had reorganized, but on the order of sometimes several millimeters, which is a lot of distance in the brain. This was extended to the human. So Ramachandran at University of California, San Diego, for example, demonstrated that human adults with amputations, after about 6 weeks after the amputation, would sometimes show things like phantom limb, sensation in the missing limb. So a male, for example, might realize that when they shave, they get a tingling in the missing hand. Well, using magnetic encephalography, it was revealed, again, just like the monkeys, that the area of the somatosensory cortex adjacent to the amputated limb. So, just a step back, the somatosensory cortex is our part of the brain involved in our sense of sensation and for example, touch. And the body is represented there, so different parts of it represent different parts of the body. So what I'm saying is that the area that represented the limb has now been encroached on by the adjacent area, which might, for example, represent the cheek. Hence, someone might get rid of the tingling in the missing limb by scratching their cheek. And so that gives yet another example of a reorganization of the somatosensory cortex. Another that I think is very intriguing has to do with musicians. So a number of years ago, a group in Konstanz, Germany, showed that professional musicians who played violins, cellos, and guitars all right-handed, they predicted that the somatosensory cortex in the right hemisphere that represents the fingers of the left hand would be bigger than A, non-musicians, and bigger than the fingers, the area of the brain in the left hemisphere representing the right hand, which might just be to strum or to bow. And again, using magnetic encephalography, that's exactly what they found. These individuals showed a larger cortical expanse in the right hemisphere that represented these fingers, but not the thumb, which doesn't do very much, and not the right hand. And these effects tended to be most pronounced in individuals who had learned their instrument before the age of 10. Now, before we use this information to cajole our children into practicing their instruments, there's an inherent confound here, which is that someone who started playing an instrument at the age of 5 and has studied at the age of 20 has 15 years of experience, versus someone who starts at the age of 18 and studied at 20 only has 2 years of experience. What this group then did is, if you give mass training to individuals, you get the same effects. So it's not that you have to be very young to learn it, but if you give the equivalent amount of experience to an adult, you see the same effects. The challenge, of course, is who's willing to spend 8 to 12 hours a day getting that experience. But it's an important point that it may not necessarily be a sensitive period as much as just the sheer amount of experience. And I'll talk more about this in a moment when it comes to language. So, I will talk now about language. Two examples. It's been Alyssa Newport and others have demonstrated a number of years ago that individuals who acquire a second language before the age of 10 are more likely to speak that language without an accent. In fact, Pascal Riquiche at Yale University often complains that the reason he speaks with this thick accent is because he was older than 10 when he acquired his second language. This has led some to argue that there's a critical period for language acquisition. So a group in France initially demonstrated they were interested in where in the brain language was represented. So using positron emission tomography or functional magnetic resonance imaging, they could localize in the brain where your first language was represented. They started then looking at individuals who spoke a second language and found that individuals who were bilingual and spoke and learned that second language early in life, their second language was represented in the same area as their first language. But if they acquired the language later in life, then it was represented in an adjacent area. That would argue for early acquisition. But in follow-up studies, they discovered that it wasn't how old you were when you learned the language, but the degree of mastery. So if you are truly bilingual, it doesn't matter if you master that second language at the age of 20 or 30. If you are truly bilingual, the second language is represented in the same place as the first language. So like the trained instrument player, it's the amount of experience. And we know this from even basic sensory functions. Eric Knudsen at Stanford University, who studies the auditory system in barn owls, has shown a very steep critical period in being ability to localize sounds in the environment early in life. But he's also shown that if you give adult barn owls huge amounts of experience, you can eventually improve your performance. So these are examples of how the mature organism, the mature somatosensory system and motor systems, can reorganize well beyond the infancy period. And of course, recovery from stroke, of course, would be a classic example of this, is how an individual suffers a stroke, loses language function or motor function, and then recovers from that. What we know generally about plasticity, then, is that development in most sensory systems depends on experience that occurs during a sensitive period of development. So for the sense of vision and hearing and the like, probably those first few years of life. Conversely, the motor and somatosensory systems appear to be modifiable throughout much of the lifespan. There are, of course, constraints. So it's going to be very difficult to learn to become a proficient violinist at the age of 40, for example. It might be tough to become a world-class tennis player at the age of 40. Now, it could be tough for other reasons, such as the general degradation of the body that occurs with aging, but leaving that aside, neurally, the point is that it's possible, it will just be more difficult. Studies of deprivation suggest that positive early caregiving experiences are important in regulating aspects of social emotional development, but the very fact that there are effective interventions, be they psychological or psychopharmacological, suggests still plasticity in these systems. So an example of that I might give is that a number of years ago, a paper was published looking at individual adults with obsessive compulsive disorder. And so they took individuals with OCD before treatment. They did PET scans and showed that the individuals all showed the same pattern of hypoactivation in one part of their brain. Half the group then got a pharmacological treatment and half the group got a behavioral treatment. Both groups improved to the same degree, and when they then did PET scans, they observed the same changes in the brain. So the pathway to reorganizing the brain was different. It was either pharmacological or behavioral, but the effect, the end result was the same. The same change in behavior and the same change in the brain. So what we're not clear about is cognition, which is actually near and dear to my own heart and Dr. Fisher's. One aspect of cognitive development requires experience at a particular point in development in order for cognitive development to proceed normally. So we know from intervention studies that children at risk, for example, for by virtue of poverty, put into intervention programs tend to do better, but those programs need to be maintained for many, many years for those effects to hold. So what we need to ask ourselves is what aspects of learning and memory require a sensitive period, and it may be not many. If learning and memory is an experience-dependent system, perhaps it's an open system, and it's something that we're capable of doing for many, many years. So, to summarize then, the likelihood of a given behavioral system exhibiting plasticity seems to depend on whether the system being challenged is one that has had the right experience to set it correctly in the beginning, whose function is somehow essential to the child early in life, such as the ability to see. That depends on neural circuits whose elaboration requires exposure to particular types of experiences during a sensitive period of time, and that might require continual challenges or maintenance thereafter. That makes us question this very concept of critical periods. In fact, I'd much prefer the term sensitive period in the human, because I'm hard-pressed to think of critical periods in behavioral development, although I can think of sensitive periods. We should recognize that some behavioral and brain systems are going to be formed earlier than others, that some experiences are going to be more important at particular points in time than others. And finally, the big challenge is that there are always going to be individual differences. And so no two people are going to be alike in the degree to which they exhibit plasticity. And understanding why that is and who those individuals are is yet another challenge. And with that, I think I'll end.